Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Welcome to our hosts, Gina McAndrews, Susan Franson, and Paul Wearson.
Well, we're all happy to be here to greet our listeners. Thanks for listening. We'll start with a couple of stories that deal with breaking news, and we'll end with small-town summer festivals. But the first story is one that, as you'll see, is also a personal story. So I think without further ado, we'll just begin this story.
KHOI doesn't usually have a chance to do a story about nationwide breaking news, but last week I was asked to cover the following story. I'll read from the report by Laura Strickler for U.S. News, updated July 21st, 2021. Three major drug distributors and the pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson have agreed to a $26 billion settlement with states to resolve thousands of lawsuits over the country's opioid crisis, officials announced Wednesday. The four companies, which include Cardinal Health, AmerisourceBergen, and McKinsey-Kesson, were accused by states, cities, and counties of playing a significant role in funneling a flood of opioid painkillers to communities across the U.S. The drugs led to the overdose deaths of more than 500,000 people from 2009 to 2019, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Quote, "This was a person-made crisis," unquote, Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro said at a press conference announcing the settlement. Quote, "This epidemic was manufactured by an army of pharmaceutical executives," unquote. The agreement still requires the approval of more than 40 states and hundreds of cities and counties. Once it is finalized, it would result in billions of dollars flowing to states to be used for prevention, treatment, and recovery. At first, I refused to cover this story because I was aware of a different perspective and I couldn't ethically present my opinions. As listeners know, the opinions expressed on KHOI are those of our guests, not members of the KHOI staff. Full disclosure, Stefan Franzen, who came back to Ames for a visit over the past weekend, is my son. His opinion of the lawsuit and what leads up to it is part of the story in his self-published book, Patient Z. Welcome, Stefan. Since you're in town for the interview, I'll let you introduce yourself and let you explain why you decided to write this book.
Well, thank you, Susan. It's really great to be here. And this book really arose quite spontaneously because of my involvement with a pain patient and going to pain clinics on a monthly basis and trying to get this person some kind of relief because I could see month by month and year by year the deteriorating health. And what goes with that for many people is pain. And so my expertise is in chemistry. I'm a chemistry professor at North Carolina State University. I do physical chemistry and biophysical chemistry as my areas. But I've also done a lot of research that is basically biomedical research. And so I have a knowledge of certain systems. I sometimes regret not having gone to medical school, but I probably would have passed out if I ever had to cut into a cadaver, so it's probably a good thing. Nonetheless, I can read the literature and I can appreciate, receptors and drugs and how they interact and how they trigger different responses in the body and that kind of thing. I will say that the brain is surprisingly complicated. Well, maybe not surprisingly, but it's complicated. And I don't have a good grasp of all of the various interactions in the brain by any means, but I do think I understand how pain is dampened by the drugs that we call opioids. I think I have a really good handle on that. And so that's what kind of led me to ask some questions like, why is patient Z having such difficulty finding an appropriate level of pain medication. And I would go in the literature, you know, patient Z would tell me, you know, they're telling me I have to take this amount. I go in the literature and find that for 35 years, people who were prescribed opioids for whatever reason were prescribed higher doses than that, not massively higher doses. And we can talk about this question of the changes that happened more recently, but that was the way it was for a very long time. And then something happened, and I call that the compassionate care movement.
Oh, the compassionate care movement. Well, what's that?
Well, basically, no one really gave it a name. But in fact, in 1996 and 97, two American pain societies published issues of their journals that recommended a more open approach to prescribing opioids. What were they after? Let me give you a feeling for this. We know that cancer patients at the end of life can receive opioids, right? You go into hospice and you can receive opioids. And that's all, of course, carefully controlled, and, you know, people make sure that no one's overdosing, et cetera, et cetera. But for many years now, people have been experimenting with painkilling drugs for cancer patients, even when they're not at the end of life, because more and more cancer patients are living longer and longer, so they're living with this pain. And if the logic is, we're going to give you this drug for the last 6 months of your life because you're in pain, it's sort of hard to justify not giving the same drug to someone who's in pain who's going to live for 3 years or 10 years. And so they started doing that. And then some of the doctors began to ask the question, well, why only cancer? Is cancer the only painful condition we have? Of course not, right? We have everything from multiple sclerosis to ankylosing spondylitis to psoriatic arthritis. I mean, there are so many conditions where people are living in terrible pain. Their bodies are being attacked by their immune system. A lot of things are happening besides the pain, but they're in pain. And sometimes the pain is so debilitating that people simply cannot stand. They cannot walk because of the pain. They're stuck in a chair or in their apartment. They can't do anything. In patient Z's case, that happened initially. The disease came on, and it was not diagnosed, and so patient Z couldn't get the kind of drugs that he needed. And then, at the time, he had a very good doctor, primary care doctor. And at the time, it's not that long ago, this primary care doctor prescribed opioids for him. And I remember when he first got the opioids, and he called me up and he said, you know, I can't take these. These are drugs. These are poisons. I said, look, you're in pain. You're in pain. There's a difference between a person in pain and a person who's not in pain. We can talk about that later. But you're in pain. You should take them. The doctor prescribed them for you. See if it doesn't make you feel better. And the next day he called me up and he said, I feel better. Now, how many times does that happen, by the way, right? You go to the doctor and you say, I'm sick, and, you know, something. These drugs really do work. I'm not saying they don't have a dangerous side. I'm not trying to simplify that. And I think my big point here in writing the book is there's too much one-sided reporting about this. We need to look at both sides of this issue.
How did this become so complicated?
How did it become so complicated? So it starts with the compassionate care movement. Again, my name, the compassionate care movement was, as it sounds, you say, well, how could, you know, what could go wrong here? This is a good idea, isn't it, to look at very sick people and to expand their treatment. But what happened at the same time was that some people in industry, in the pharmaceutical industry, sort of caught wind of what was going on in academic and other circles, and saw an opportunity for themselves. And so, in particular, a couple of smaller players, I would even go so far as to call them rogue companies, got involved in a way that would maximize their profit. And this is somewhat complicated because you have to explain, you know, who the players are and so that. So I'm not sure if we want to do that right now. But, you know, the simple fact is this, right, that a minority of companies, a small number of companies with a very relative, I don't want to say very small, but relatively small part of market share even, they did the things that are now criminal. For example, paying doctors kickbacks for writing prescription for opioids. I mean, that's awful. We can all agree that's awful. And I indeed, as a result of that kind of thing, there were people who got hooked on the prescription drugs. But I guess one of my biggest points to make is we really have to separate in our thinking what a doctor prescribes in their office from what happens when we see drug overdoses. These are two very different things. And yet the media really talks today as though somehow they're directly linked, as though dying of the drug overdoses are being prescribed those drugs by their doctors. This is not true. I mean, it's a small, small minority of overdoses that come directly from a doctor's prescription that are not diverted prescription drugs. They're not heroin or methamphetamine or fentanyl, something else, right? The vast majority are these drugs that have been, with the exception of fentanyl, they've been around for a while. I mean, we've been having epidemics of opioid and cocaine and methamphetamine overdoses for years and years and years and years. And in fact, that is very much linked to the politics at the national level. And
how did the war on drugs come into this? Didn't they work on the overdose rate?
Well, yeah. So therein is what I'm getting at is that we've essentially criminalized medicine in the United States by creating an agency that not only the Drug Enforcement Administration not only is responsible for interdicting drugs that are coming in over our borders and, you know, catching criminals who distribute drugs inside the United States and all of that, but they also have been given the mandate to police our doctors and to tell our doctors today, actually, to tell our doctors how much they can prescribe. That didn't happen before. This is a reaction to the compassionate care movement. The DEA, of course, was always in the picture ever since the 1980s. And so, you know, obviously they were supposed to interdict drugs and get the drugs off the streets and bring the overdose rate down and bring the addiction rate down. And in fact, in their congressional review of 2004, they were given 0% success. They are one of the most spectacularly failed government agencies of all time. And in fact, in 2004, they came up with a new idea to try to justify their existence because they knew that they had failed completely. And so their new idea, instead of a war on drugs, was to have a war on prescription drugs. Which, if you think about that, it sounds almost crazy. Now, in their mind, I think what they were thinking was, what they were trying to convey was that, yes, some prescription drugs are diverted, right? They're stolen, they are... some people sell them that they shouldn't, of course, and there are various ways that drugs can be diverted, and there are lots of studies of that. But they decided to have a diversion organization or diversion division, and an interesting thing was that that diversion division receives no federal funds. So the people who work in that division get all their money from confiscating money from drug kingpins, well, and doctors. Right? So if you're a doctor who prescribes opioids and one of your patients dies, they can allege murder. And so suddenly you're a doctor who's, you know, been treating a patient's pain, and now, next thing you know, and the way they do it, by the way, they don't just, you know, send you a letter and say, oh, we're, you know, appear in court in this day. No, they come in with a SWAT team with, you know, automatic weapons, burst the door down, and terrifying patients. And this is, there are uncounted numbers of these kind of raids that have happened in doctors' offices. And they have websites where they say that there are workshops for doctors to learn how to prescribe. You and I cannot know what they say because you have to have a DEA license, you know, the kind that allows you to prescribe opioids. You have to be a nurse or a doctor. The rest of us don't even get to know what the DEA is telling these nurses and doctors. So it's rather disturbing that a government agency that oversees all production, they set the production quotas for opioids too, they oversee all production, and they can control all facets of this, is never mentioned in a lot of these media reports as though somehow, you know, these things just happened. No, they didn't just happen. The DEA actually set them in motion. And then, at a later time, when they became catastrophic, wanted to turn the finger of blame on somebody. And I'm not saying, again, that there's only one person or one group to blame. The DEA has certainly played a major role in this, but these rogue companies have played a role in this, and there are other actors.
Is Purdue Pharma one of these rogue companies?
Yes, it is. It's the largest of the rogue companies. So if we think about the recent big news about these opioid settlements for $28 billion, it's a strong analogy, actually, with the tobacco settlement. What's supposed to happen here is this money is supposed to be used to alleviate the problems that have arisen because of addiction, as though these companies are directly responsible for that, which is an assertion that in the case of Johnson & Johnson, for example, I challenge, because Johnson & Johnson, a large manufacturer, they make opioids that are pretty cheap. They're not, they don't have a huge profit margin. They're not, this is not a, you know, a, some kind of hot drug for them, right? It is a, like aspirin or ibuprofen. It's just something that's needed in the medical world. They make a lot of it, and they make their money on the volume. But there were some companies like Purdue. Purdue's the, perhaps the most famous. And what Purdue did was to hold conferences, I guess they called them. They invited doctors, and they convinced doctors that their drug was not tamper-proof. In other words, it, you couldn't crush it up and use it to snort or to inject the way that you could other drugs. That was not true, but, you know, it sounded good. And they convinced doctors that the addiction rate for everyone was uniquely low, like around 1%. And that's not true. But on the other hand, the addiction rate is not 45 or 50% like a lot of the opponents are saying either. It's more like 4% for a healthy person who has never been exposed to opioids before and is given opioids regularly by a doctor without any oversight. And it is about 1% for pain patients, and we can talk about that later. Why pain patients? Why are they different from everybody else? There's a good physiological explanation for that. But in any case, what Purdue had was a product that was under patent. The patent issued in 1996. Johnson & Johnson's drugs that they made, like morphine, slow-release morphine, has been under patent since 1943. So the patent long since lapsed. It's now a generic, really, and there's no big profit in it. But Purdue was selling a drug that was recently patented. And so if they could grab more market share, they could get super profits because they were probably charging prices that were 50 to 100 times as high per gram as the others were for essentially the same drug, because the drug they were selling was a time-release oxycodone. Well, you can buy oxycodone. It's not expensive, but the time-release formulation, that was the trick. So they had to convince people that this time-release formulation was essential, even though there's a time-release formulation of morphine and time-release formulation of a bunch of other drugs. So why is that, you know, so novel? It wasn't. Oxycodone has been known for a very long time. It's not a new drug. So, again, this was marketing. And it was marketing done in a very cynical way, because in the end, what they did was they gave doctors kickbacks for writing prescriptions, which is, of course, what they... You know, I mean, we can argue about the false advertising, whether the 1% or the 4%, when does that apply, et cetera, et cetera. You know, obviously the statement that should be made is these drugs have a potential downside and a potential danger, and it's a significant one. The people who need them really need them, and the people who have a proclivity towards abusing them, well, we need to help them in the same way that we need to help pain patients. So I'm not suggesting there's really any difference. There are people who have a medical issue, and that's what we need to be addressing. So, again, Purdue Pharma was trying to downplay this addiction problem to the point where they were saying basically, oh, it just doesn't exist, right? As though 1% is a negligible number. Well, if 10 million people are prescribed opioids every year and 1% of them become addicted, that's still a problem. So it's not like, you know, they weren't being honest in any sense of the word, is what I would say. A lot of the things they were saying came from the literature, and there was a core of truth too, but then the context that they put it in was like, hey, there's no problem, just go ahead and prescribe, it's nothing bad's going to happen. And of course that led to some deaths directly from medical prescribing. And there's, of course, always will be some directly from medical prescribing, which, by the way, is true for many drugs, not just opioids. So, you know, we really need balance here about what are the causes, what are the effects of all of this, and who is being affected. However, for many of these diseases, and I mean, I'm counting everything from multiple sclerosis to rheumatoid arthritis, some patients, significant number of patients, have so much tissue damage, right? Their knees are falling apart, their hips are falling apart, their tendons are inflamed and, you know, diseased, that they just have so much pain, they cannot walk unless they have some kind of pain medication. And to my way of thinking, it's simply inhumane to not give people pain medication under those circumstances.
In case you just tuned in,
this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we have just been listening to Stefan Franzen, who was talking about the opioid crisis and his book Patient Z, which has a different interpretation than is usually in the press. Our next guest, Al Wombo, also has a breaking news story, and he's with us now. So I think I'd ask you, Al, to introduce yourself and why you told me yesterday you wanted to be on today.
Good morning, Susan, and thank you for having me on once again. My name is Al Womble, and I'm the chair of the Iowa Black Caucus, and I also work with a nonpartisan nonprofit organization called Vision 2020, which is going to be spearheading my efforts that I'll be taking in Davenport. But the reason that I wanted to speak to your listeners today, Susan, is because of a very serious situation that is going on in my hometown of Davenport, Iowa. There are 46 families which are about to become homeless in Davenport come August 1st. I just learned about this about a week ago, and I'm trying to coordinate with different individuals and different agencies to help these folks. And the story is this in a nutshell. In November, the city of Davenport rental inspectors ordered Crestwood Apartments to make extensive repairs to the complex to correct a lengthy list of code violations, including leaky roof, unsanitary conditions, failing smoke detection systems, and follow-up inspections by the city to verify that the repairs have been made, show that the repairs were canceled and never rescheduled. And the local property manager told the inspector that he did not have the resources to make it happen. So on May 27th, the city issued a 60-day notice to the complex owner to make the repairs or the city would condemn the property. Management then posted letters to let the tenants know that the property had been sold at the end of July and that they would have to vacate by August 1st. Now, this particular apartment complex, Crestwood Apartments in Davenport, Iowa, contains primarily low-income families. And so I don't know if any of your listeners have ever had to live paycheck to paycheck or struggle with finances and resources, you know, where just making rent every month is a struggle. But that's what the majority of these folks who live in these apartments are facing. And now suddenly being faced with sudden eviction, you know, many of them do not have the resources to suddenly pick up and move, especially with such short notice, being told that at, you know, the end of July, they were informed of this decision. And now in just a couple days, there are many of these people who have still not secured housing. There was a meeting that they had with Davenport City Council asking for an extension. That particular extension was denied. Unfortunately, there was a city council member who made the statement that, well, these people were living in squalor. Should we allow them to continue to live in squalor? And, you know, my response would be that perhaps the living conditions there weren't great, but your solution is to make these people homeless. That is irresponsible and reckless. So 1 month before school is supposed to start, there are going to be families, children, elderly individuals who now have no place to leave. There was just yesterday a meeting at the Crestwood Apartments where city council members and the mayor were invited to come and speak to the Crestwood Apartment residents. And unfortunately, you know, many of them still have not been to secure any place to live. Many of them are finding that different apartment complexes in Davenport are not only out of their price range, but some are not allowing the Crestwood Apartment residents to actually even rent from them. Because they know that they have come from a condemned property. And, you know, right now there are funds that could be released by the state to help these individuals from the Iowa Finance Authority. Unfortunately, the Iowa Finance Authority has been very lax in releasing these funds to help these people find housing. And there is a backlog of individuals who are facing this housing crisis. So right now, the organization that I work with is attempting to collect supplies to help these folks. We're accepting clothing, obviously packing boxes, packing tape, children's toys, food, and other items. You know, if individuals wish to help out, I would urge them to contact me at awomble71@gmail.com. Because the worst of it is not just that families are going to be going homeless, but there are lots of small children that are facing a situation where their parents are angry and confused and struggling. And these small kids have nothing to do with it, yet they're suffering doubly by not only being, you know, in a situation where they're losing their homes, but also where their parents are going under extreme mental stress with this situation. And these kids need help and need a break. But with that, I'll pause and see if, Susan, you have any questions for me. Obviously, we're trying to move as quickly as we can to collect donations and supplies to help these folks. So I urge you, if you can hear my voice, then please contact me and make sure that you see how you can help. Because right now, I don't know if you've ever struggled with homelessness yourself, but the fact that there are going to be 46 families, over 100 people, that are going to be homeless on August 1st, to me, is a tragedy and is something that we as Iowans need to do something about, even if the state of Iowa itself is not going to do anything about it.
Thank you, Al. You asked if I had any questions. Well, I think I'll turn the questioning over to Gina, but I do have one question. Do you have a website? If people are concerned, they can either contribute or find out some other way they can help.
Right now, we're still building the website because Vision 2020 is still fairly new. One of the best ways, like I say, that individuals can do is by contacting me through my email, which is awomble71@gmail.com. I'm coordinating efforts with different agencies here in central Iowa as well as in Davenport in order to make sure that we are, you know, getting supplies and getting assistance to these folks. And, you know, obviously one of the things we're going to need to do is be able to show up back down there with individuals willing to help when we are attempting to relocate these folks someplace. And, you know, I guess my heart is just really broken by the fact that during that meeting, you know, we had one elderly couple who both of them work, but neither of them make much money. Both have disabilities. And, you know, they were crying, wondering, where are they going to go? And the man said, well, I'm probably going to have to go to jail just to be able to have a roof over my head. And then the wife started crying and said, you know, that I'm going to lose my husband because he's right. The only place he would be able to go to find any sort of housing is in jail. You know, it's terrible to think that this is happening in our state. And yet there, other than we as fellow Iowans reaching out to help these folks, there is very little help that's being given.
That's very hard to believe, and it's sure disappointing. And then I'm from just up the river in Dubuque, so I'm connected to Davenport. Do you want to give your email once again for and spell it out, maybe in case?
Yeah, it's awomble71@gmail.com. Normally, I would love to be able to give you a website to go to, but like I say, we're still constructing some of those websites because it's a new organization that I'm working with.
And when folks contact you, what are some ways they can help?
So there's three things that we're attempting to do right now. So number one is to collect supplies to give to these folks. And some of those supplies that we're attempting to collect is clothing of any size. Like I said, there's going to be, you know, men, women, children, elderly who we need clothing for, food, packing boxes, packing tape, toys, different things that we can try and give to the children in order to help them out. And then we also need to see if there's anybody who's willing to help us when we're there on August 7th, is when we're going to be in Davenport to distribute these supplies, and also to see if we can help individuals by either renting vehicles to help them move, or seeing what other moving expenses we might be able to cover by raising funds in order to help these individuals. So donation of the supplies I mentioned, you know, clothing, food, packing boxes, packing tape, kids' toys, individuals who might be willing to be with me in Davenport on August 7th to specifically help these folks, and individuals who might be able to help provide resources so that we can rent vehicles to help these folks move. It's a tragic situation.
Where do you move them to? Yeah. More stuff. I mean, it sounds like it. I mean, if they're already have a home and they're going to be homeless, having them with more stuff.
Well, I understand the concern there. But when I spoke to the volunteers in Davenport, you know, these were the needs that these individuals said that they had. I mean, we have to remember that these are individuals who are living in financial crisis. So it's not like these individuals already had a plethora of their needs being met. For those of us who live in nice, comfortable homes, have closets full of clothes, have pantries filled with goods, that's not the condition that most of these people find themselves in right now, let alone the fact that they are going to be homeless and then have to spend all their spare money on attempting to find a place to live. You know, when you live paycheck to paycheck, you're not going to have full closets and full pantries.
Anybody looked into taking donations to help them find places to live, like other apartment buildings?
Yes, yes. So,
you know, that would maybe cover the first month's rent or something like that.
Yes, I'm working with an agency within Davenport, Iowa called the Open Door Assistance Agency. And we are going to be setting up a GoFundMe page in order to assist these individuals. And I'm going to be putting that information out on not only my own Facebook page, but the Facebook page of the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus, Instagram, and also try and email it around to folks who may be willing to help, so that we can also raise some funds to help these folks. You know, I know for many of us who've never been in that situation, you know, it's very confusing. But at the same point in time, if you're someone who does live paycheck to paycheck, there are a lot of needs that already are not being met. And now this is one more step in the process that is creating greater hardship for these families.
Yes, no, I completely understand. I mean, being without things. I just thought for the majority of people, it might be easier to donate $100 than try and get you a couple bags full of clothes or something
right.
like that.
Right, and that that GoFundMe page, we're going to get set up today. And once I get that set up, I will make sure that I also send that off to Susan. So that if there's any way that you folks can help distribute that information, that would be great, because, you know, right now, yeah, one of the things that we need is individuals who can donate the money so that we can help them secure some type of housing or help them meet, you know, their needs, so that we can give whatever assistance is necessary to these folks.
And do you know what that's going to be called? Those people, I mean, I know you'll send it, but just for, like, will it be called Davenport Project or something?
Yeah, what we're going to call it is the Davenport Crestwood Emergency Assistance.
I just meant if somebody went to GoFundMe later tomorrow, they could find it.
Yeah, Davenport Crestwood Emergency Assistance, what we're going to call it. So
and
that that way.
Going to be the name of the Facebook page, too?
I'll be posting it on different Facebook pages. I'll see if I can create an event page for that.
Okay.
And post that out, see if we can create a Facebook page for that. But Davenport Crestwood Emergency Assistance. So look for that on GoFundMe. That will be up later today. I was looking at creating that last night, but unfortunately there was another emergency situation here in Des Moines that I had to respond to. You know, unfortunately, when you're someone who works in the community and is a community activist, things just don't stop.
Thank you very much for being with us today to let us know about ways that we can participate and be a little.
Thank you very much for all your work you're doing to help people around the state, including those, you know, especially those in Davenport right now.
That was Al Womble from the Vision 2020.
the organization that you're currently working through.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Your hosts for today have been Gina McAndrews, Paul Wearson, and I, Susan Franzen. So far this hour, we have been dealing with some pretty serious issues. Now it's time to have a little fun with the festivals we love so much in our listening area. Gilbert Days with Terry Gallahan and Scandinavian Days with Paul Wearson and Shannon McKinley. On July 30th and 31st, Gilbert is having their summer festival, Gilbert Days, and Terry Gallahan is here to tell us about it.
Hi. Well, to start off, the Gilbert Franklin Firefighters are having a pulled pork dinner. That's at 6 o'clock, and it will be out on the parking lot, weather permitting, of course, of the fire station. And that's a pulled pork dinner. It's delicious pulled pork. We have mac and cheese and beans to go with that, soft drinks, water. And then there's a beer tent. The firefighters also have a beer tent, and that will run from 6 p.m. until probably 11 p.m. We have a DJ in the evening until 8:30, and then we have live music at 8:30, and that's Neil Hewitt. Also at 6:30 to 9:30, we have laser tag and inflatables for the children, or the big kids also for laser tag. And we'll have pint-size ice cream. We'll also be here for our Friday night celebration. At dusk, weather permitting, we have fireworks. If it rains, we'll have the fireworks Saturday evening. So that's our schedule for Friday.
Well, it sounds like a pretty great way to start out the weekend.
Yes, for sure. And then on Saturday, we begin at 8 o'clock in the morning with a pancake breakfast, also at the fire station. And there is a car show and a tractor show that also begins at 8 o'clock and runs until 1 p.m. And those two shows will be in the north parking lot of Gilbert High School, which is just south of the fire station in the community building. The kids will have a bike parade at 10:30, and there will be carnival games in the high school commons from 10:30 to noon. There also will be a puppet show right outside of the high school building at that same time from 10:30 to noon. The scouts will have mini golf from 10:30 to 2, and there will be a pedal tractor pull for the kids. It is a contest, and I believe they go by weights, not ages, but I'm not sure this year, and that's from 11 to 2. Then the Lions Club will serve lunch. They grill burgers. That is 11 o'clock to 1 p.m., and the Historical Society will also have a bake sale at the same time, and that's inside the community building, which holds City Hall and the fire station. We have Sweet Swirls rolled ice cream that's out in the parking lot from 11 in the morning clear through till 10 p.m. And we have the kids' inflatables from noon to 9:30, which also includes laser tag. At 1 o'clock, from 1 to 3, we will have museum tours, and our museum is on Main Street. From 1 to 4 p.m., the Alluvial Brewing Company will give tours every half hour. And this is a great opportunity for people of the community to see just what a local brewing company is all about. And that is out by Prairie Moon Winery. At 4 p.m., the beer tent starts up again, and we also will have some food trucks in town, also in the parking lot at the fire station. There is a bags tournament that begins at 5, and then at 8 p.m. we have live music again from 8 p.m. to 11:30, and that is Red Dirt Renegade. And that's our busy day on Saturday.
And you'll have fireworks on Saturday night if it rains on Friday night.
If it rains on Friday night, yes, we'll have fireworks on Saturday night.
It sounds like there are lots of fun events, but it's also a great way to get to know Gilbert.
We always have a lot of alumni return for Gilbert Days. Many of them have class reunions during that time so that they can see other alumni and partake in all the festivities of Gilbert Days.
You told me earlier that it was a fairly old festival and then it had a hiatus.
Well, the very first Gilbert Days was done in 1976. And that was with the United States Bicentennial. We had our celebration, and we continued that through the 80s. Many things happening then were a little bit different than what we do now. But we had a rodeo in the 80s, and that was the biggest attraction was the rodeo. We also had slow pitch tournaments, and we had a pig roast. We had water fights. Garden tractor pole, we had a grease pig, things like that back in the 80s. Then it kind of died out, and we started back up again in 2015. It used to be on Main Street, and we kind of didn't have a whole lot of room there to do things, and so we went out to the fire station, so we had more room to do things inside and outside. On Main Street, it had to be outside all the time, and so we needed that indoors facilities to help out.
I hope a lot of people who didn't know about all that's going on in Gilbert Days will be able to go over to Gilbert and find out.
Oh, I hope so. Please do join us. I know the weather's going to be warm, but we will have indoor, outdoor things going on, and you can always cool off inside and, you know, go back outside too.
Thank you so much, Terry. That was Terry Gallahan, one of the organizers of Gilbert Days, which will take place this weekend starting at 6 p.m. on Friday evening with a pulled pork supper at the firehouse, followed by a full evening of events with music by Neil Hewitt, and, if it doesn't rain, fireworks at dusk.
You just heard from Terry Gallahan, telling us about Gilbert's celebration of Gilbert Days next Friday and Saturday. Paul Wearson, our other host, will be joining us right now with Shannon McKinley, the director of Story City's Greater Chamber Connection, to give us a recap of Story City's abbreviated Scandinavian Days and Carousel Festival. Paul?
Yes. Yeah, we had a big weekend, and Susan, I want to compliment you on all your variety today. We've gone from the opioid crisis to homelessness to the upcoming festival in Gilbert. I would say you're just as much of a variety show as Ed Sullivan today, okay? You got to be old to remember Ed Sullivan. Anyway, we had the Great Scandinavian Days, an abbreviated one-day event this past Saturday, and Shannon, you're here, right? It was a good festival. It was up by the swimming pool, right by the North Park, and everything was in a concentrated area. And I have to admit that I was late getting there. And just to suggest how successful the vendors were, I stopped at the Kiwanis stand, and they were sold out. They had done everything, and they were packing up. And I played bingo at the Lions Club tent, and that was a full-blown concern. And, of course, the carousel was going, and the swimming pool was full. And down at St. Peter Lutheran Church, they were selling Kumbla on a stick, and they sold out in an hour. So all your feedback from vendors must be good, Shannon.
Absolutely. We all are just excited to have some kind of event back after our year of lockdown, and yeah, everybody had a very successful day. Kringla sold out in 2 hours, and Kumla, yes, was in less than an hour. And the Kiwanis sold lunch and served over 300 in just 2 hours.
So it was very nice just to see the community support and have just a community celebration and a welcome and see everybody again.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that, and I was witness to it. I just thought I could still eat when I got there, but man, it was so successful that they were sold out already. And the North Park was really a great location. Story City has a North and a South Park, and the South Park is very famous for the swinging bridge and all the activities that are possible there. But the North Park is where the carousel is and where all the concessions took place. And there's a beautiful little stream that goes through the North Park. I was shocked on Saturday. This is in conjunction with what we're all concerned about, with the drought. In my lifetime, growing up in Story City, even though I lived in Des Moines for years, I've never, ever seen that little stream, that creek, dry. And Saturday, it was bone dry. And that's a measurement of how serious the water shortage and drought is in this part of the nation right now. So that was kind of startling. But everything else about the festival was A-OK. And looking back, how do you evaluate it, Shannon? Success?
I would say definitely a success, as it wasn't like our normal Scandinavian days, as everybody knows. With adapting and changing it, we felt it was a very successful town celebration this year.
And you also had some musical groups there. Were there two or three of those?
We actually had three musical groups throughout the day. It started with Kenny Freddy at lunchtime. So when people were eating their lunch, they got to listen to the Kenny Freddy band in the park. Then it went to Hawk McIntyre starting at 3 o'clock. And then at 6 o'clock was Hank Anthony. And so they all had a great crowd. Our North Park has wonderful shade trees. So everybody just got to sit on their blanket or on a chair and just enjoy some entertainment and snack on cotton candy and snow cones and popcorn, whatever made them happy that afternoon.
No, I attended some of those, at least one or two of those concerts. And that's another feature of the North Park. This is a beautiful brick bandstand built somewhere in the 30s or 40s. Anyway, it's been there for a long time. It's very sturdy, and it's been refurbished and brought up to date. And, of course, it faces a nice, gentle hillside, so it's sort of a natural amphitheater effect, and people can sit in their lawn chairs, and it's all shaded, too. It's not out in the sun, so I think there ought to be more concerts there because it's such a hospitable atmosphere. And you sit in total shade, and actually the bandstand itself is in the sun, so it was so hot that they had to have a canopy over the performers because the sun was beating directly down on the concert stand. Now, it was also National Carousel Day, right, Shannon?
National Carousel Day was on Sunday. It's always July 25th. So we were open in three different shifts, just kind of to give a break from the heat for my staff that was working. We had a very successful day. I think the person that drove the farthest that day was 5 hours to come see us.
Yeah, the carousel is, of course, one of the main attractions in Story City. And it's in a beautiful pavilion. And on the wall, you have a world map where people can put pins to denote their origin. And, of course, we're so conveniently located on an exit of the Interstate Highway 35 that it's amazing. People from all over the world come to see the carousel just off the Interstate Highway. And I'm always fascinated to look at that map at the end of the summer and see the tremendous variety of visitors, not only from all over America, but all over the world. And so the carousel features, what's a 1913 mechanical?
Yep, 1913.
With a wonderful old Wurlitzer pipe organ. And it's just fun to watch kids. I volunteered there many times, and it's a fantastic thing there. You've got popcorn and all kinds of things you can buy there, souvenirs and everything. But I always have fun watching the kids. And for the little kids, There are two possible reactions to the carousel: absolute terror and absolute delight. And it's always fun to watch that and to answer questions, and also to let people know what the history of the carousel is and how it came to be in Story City, and the fact that the businessmen in Story City had a conflict in renting a carousel. It used to be packed up and carried away by a private proprietor, and there was some sort of conflict in the schedule, and he had committed for a shorter time than was needed, and so the businessmen just bought the carousel. And so from that time on, the city, or at least a consortium of businessmen, owned the carousel, and it was torn down every year and stored in outbuildings and farms. And of course, over time, this carousel and all the horses and the various animals that were in the carousel and all the equipment was really degraded by temperature extremes, just wear and tear. So in the early 1980s, Story City raised a lot of money to refurbish, to hire artisans who redid the horses and all the animals for the carousel and updated everything. And they raised money to build this huge pavilion in which to house the carousel. So this is a very intensive volunteer effort every year. It was a very intensive fundraising effort originally in the early 80s. And now, of course, everything stays in that pavilion year-round, and it's temperature-controlled. And because this carousel is a 1913 edition, and it's an antique, it's extremely valuable. I think each horse is worth $20,000. And it's a fantastic thing that they have in Story City, and a real attraction. And wrapping things up, Shannon, what grade would you give the Scandinavian Day celebration this year?
Well, an A for sure.
And next year, we're going to do the whole shamil again, right?
That is the plan.
So
we're looking forward to it the weekend of June 3rd and 4th next year, 2022.
That's right. Everyone there is listening today, remember Scandinavian Days is always the first weekend in June. It'll be next year full-blown with a parade, a two-day celebration, so we'll be back to normal. Shannon, thank you, and I actually encountered you on Saturday, I think. You said hi.
Yes, we did. Thanks so much, Paul, for having me this morning.
Okay. Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Susan Franzen, Paul Wearson, and myself, Gina McAndrews.
Our guests were Stefan Franzen, author of Patient Z, a book about policies for pain patients caught in the opioid crisis. Al Wombo, who gave us information about how we could help the residents of Crestwood Apartments in Davenport who are all about to be evicted. For Central Iowa, we have Terry Gallahan telling us about Gilbert Days and Shannon McKinley giving us a wrap-up on Scandinavian Days. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards, from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515 292-2878. If you want to become a member, you can also go to our website, khoifm.org, and hit the yellow Donate Become a Member button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI is provided by Core Living Compost, a food waste pickup service in Ames for turning your spoil into soil. Information on this service is at corelivingcompost.com.